So good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
You know, our introduction to Zazen is becoming so popular, we're getting an overflow down here because we can't fit them all upstairs, which is great. When the Buddha woke up, he recognized three things about all unenlightened human beings. And the first was what he called impermanence. And what he meant by impermanence is that everything that arises to our experience can change. Nothing is permanent. And if you haven't thought about it, and there are meditations on impermanence. And so you can think about, well, what is permanent? You might think, well, what about mountains? If we could go back several million years ago, there were great volcanoes on the north shore of Minnesota along Lake Superior, and they're now eroded down. If we think about relationships and job and health, whatever we can think about, basically we'll see that there's impermanence. Just a little meditation will see that that's not really a hard concept to hold on to. Okay? A second characteristic of all unenlightened human beings, according to the Buddha, is something he calls suffering. In Sanskrit, they call it dukkha, and that just refers to a feeling of unease. It can go all the way from, suffering a real illness. Maybe somebody in your family died, Emerson, the essayist, referred to it, said that everybody lives a life of quiet desperation. And that can be something like, geez, did I remember to take the kid out of the closet? There's a dog in the backyard. Am I going to be able to pick the kid up at school? And things like this. Now, there's a difference between suffering in that sense and pain. And if I'm up at the cabin and I get up at at night and the grandkids have been there and I walk through the dark and suddenly I hit my foot on some kid toy and there's pain. And I can feel it, and the toe really hurts. And my reactive emotion is, oh, those doggone kids. Why has it happened to me, of all people? Now I'm going to limp around all day. The first part, the stubbing the toe, that's pain. The reactive emotion that arises, that's dukkha. That's suffering. Even though Buddhas suffer pain, they've learned to recognize what that reactive emotion is. That suffering, etc., and let it go. So with a little thought, we can understand suffering. You have to think about it, but it's important, a little thought. The third characteristic of all unenlightened beings, according to the Buddha, is not self. And that's a hard concept. In fact, for many people, it's the most difficult concept in Buddhism to know. Not self. You know, I can see you, you can see me. If I reach out and pinch Ben and he pinches me, we're both going to give a yelp, right? So there's some sense in which we're a self. But for the Buddha, the idea of not self really underlies, it's a core concept. There may not be a more core concept in the Buddha's teaching than not self. Because if you think you're a self, etc., you want things to remain permanent. You want your relationships and fame and job to remain permanent. All of these things, of course, are fuel for suffering. Fuel for suffering. So the other two parts of the characteristics of an unenlightened being, that is impermanence and suffering, basically are rooted in this idea of having a self. So for us in our practice, it's of fundamental importance to understand not self. Even though we're going to yelp when we get pinched. The Buddha tried to explain it, or I shouldn't say he tried, he explained it by looking at various characteristics of human beings, our body, our sensations, our perceptions, our consciousness. And he said, if you really look at all of these things, and you look at them thoroughly, there's nothing left over. There's no separate self. There's just body, sensations, perceptions, things like this. I'm going to take a different strategy, if you will, to explain not-self based upon ideas that have developed within about the last 150 years in ideas that the Dalai Lama has been exploring for the last 30 years with a physicist and neurobiologist. And when you hear those words, you think, rigid, if you will. I think by the time we're done, you'll see that they're relatively easy ideas to get a hold of, just like dukkha or suffering, and just like impermanence. And to do that, I'm going to actually use three words to help us understand what not-self might be from a modern perspective. And the three words are nonsense, Einstein. This is like Jeopardy, you know. nonsense, Einstein, and mind is such as being aware of what's on your mind. So let's start with nonsense, and I'm going to give three examples. That all of us, whether we think of it or not, or are aware of it or not, basically we have a worldview. That we share certain expectations and knowledge. We see the world in a certain way. We expect people to be in a certain way. And we call those worldviews. And when something comes along to rock our worldview, to make it less substantial, then we worry and we say, nonsense. Nonsense. It can't be so. Nonsense. And three examples. In the early 17th century, Galileo, by looking through a telescope, saw that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe. And, of course, this was a shock when he announced it because, of course, the Earth and was specially created. We were created specially in God's image, etc., etc. So to say that the Earth was not the center of the universe was a shock. Galileo said, come and look in my telescope. And they said, nonsense. Why bother to look? We're going to burn you at the stake unless you say that you didn't see it. You know, Galileo says, given those choices, I didn't see anything. Okay, but we now, of course, accept what Galileo saw. It's part of our common worldview. In the early part of the 19th century, Lyell, who was the father of geology, he looked at rocks and mountains and streams, etc., and he said, the world has to be very old. Because if you can see young mountains, you can see old mountains. And if you look at an old mountain, you realize that it had to be millions and millions and millions of years to have gotten from a young mountain to an old mountain. Just by looking at patterns of erosion, if you will. And he used a principle of uniformitarianism. It's one of those long words when I was a kid. Do you remember we all learned how to spell long words to impress everybody, and uniformitarianism was one. It's a long word, but it's a simple word. And it just really means that let's assume that the way the world works now, as far as erosion, wind, gravity, is the same way it worked in the past. And if we make that assumption, then the world has to be older than 6,000 years old. Now, when I say 6,000 years old, this was the accepted view at the time of how old the Earth was. It was thought to have been created in 4004 B.C. on a Saturday morning. I'm an anthropologist. We're interested in those things. We used to have birthday parties for the Earth on that particular day, if you will. Lyell comes along and says, no, I mean, we're talking, I mean, they couldn't imagine, they couldn't think in terms of millions and billions of years old. And in fact, there are books with titles like The Discovery of Time. We forget now that time had to be discovered, and time was discovered in the West in the early 19th century. The idea that there's a great linear time with maybe without a beginning and without an end. I mean, can you imagine? We don't think about that or read about that much anymore. But in the early 19th century, people said, nonsense, nonsense. Because obviously, by saying it was very old, you were again saying that the world was not specially created 6,000 years ago. Furthermore, there was an idea of a great decline, which you find in lots of religions. You went from a golden period to a silver period to bronze to iron, etc. And we had fallen. Etc. So here was all these ideas, and people said, nonsense, you can't be right. An even greater shock to people's worldview occurred in the middle of the 19th century with Darwin's theory of evolution. Darwin, of course, was saying that more complex animals evolved from simpler ones, that human beings share an ancestry with things like apes and monkeys, etc. And I always remember the remark heard at a dinner party, somebody saying, well, if it's true, let's hope it doesn't become widely known. but think of the shock, if you will. As you all know, there are people still who don't accept the age of the Earth is greater than 6,000 years. They think radiocarbon and other dating techniques are wrong. Certainly there are many people who don't accept the idea of evolution through time. So these all are examples of really great shocks to an accepted worldview. And that's the first part of my three words, the nonsense part. When there is a great change in how we view the world, people say nonsense. Nonsense, it can't be so. And they do this for good psychological reasons. The second word is Einstein. And in the early 19th century, Einstein came up with this theory of relativity and quantum mechanics. And at the time, people knew about things like atoms and electrons. You know that if you look at the wall or you look at the the wooden here, you know that they're made of atoms. But the idea at the time was that all of these are separate things. Sure, they're formed of atoms, and they don't have substantial nature, but they're separate things. And the idea at the time of Newton's physics was that the world is like a great clock, all of these individual parts working together. Now, Einstein comes along and says, well, if we look at the subatomic level, what we really see is just fields of energy. That's all. And these fields of energy can come into being and they can subside and disappear. They do all kinds of weird things that most of us are not familiar with. They communicate over great distances, etc. And so Einstein's saying that, no, things don't have separate existence, but rather are just emanations of this underlying energy. Now, if that's hard to understand, let me give you an analogy. Think of the waves and currents and eddies of an ocean, okay? And for practical purposes, we might want to learn something about waves and currents. If we're a ship captain, we want to learn about currents. But they're all just ocean. All there is ocean, okay? And the same thing, we can look at dogs and cats and trees and people, and for practical purposes, we can give them names, but they're just all energy, whatever we call it. We might want to call it the Tao, the Dhammakaya, ultimate reality. In Buddhism, we call it emptiness. And we say that these are manifestations of emptiness. And so you get that picture. One more time, because these are not... This is Sunday morning, right? And I know many of you are here to get free cookies and things like this. And so here I'm talking about emptiness and physics and Einstein, but I think these are absolutely fundamental concepts that we all have to get. And so we have this idea, again, that all of these things arise, they're all one. And I'll say more about that. So what about that third world word? And the third world is mind, as in watching what's on my mind, what's on my mind. As human beings, we have the capacity for language. And one thing we do with language is we label things. So when you're a little kid, your mom says, doggy, cat, tree, hot, things like this. And if you say doggy, she says, no, that's a cat, etc. And that's how you learn. And so what we're doing as part of our upbringing, normally, etc., is we're learning to give names to the separate parts of what is a whole, what has no separation, that just exists in itself, is fields of energy. Okay? Other animals don't do that. We have this capacity for language. And that's just a part of the story of being human. As human animals, for example, we see, unlike other animals, very few animals see in color. Very few animals see in three dimension. So when you have your fancy dudes on and your dog comes up and you want to say, well, look at this nice red thing, that's not what the dog sees. Okay? Speaking of dogs, if you look at a dog's brain, the olfactory bulb, the part that's connected with smell is really huge. And the part that's connected with consciousness is very small. And so a dog can smell like we can't smell. And if you look at our olfactory apparatus, of course, it's not very good. And we could go through the other senses as well, touch and hearing, etc. And in Buddhism, we actually consider consciousness a sixth sense. And so here's an idea, if you haven't thought about it, that we think in human-sized thoughts. We think in human-sized thoughts. And the point of all of that is a simple one, and that is that there's no way that we can perceive reality, ultimate reality, emptiness, as it is. Okay? We necessarily see it through our human senses, etc. So the very first part of the Dhammapada, which is a collection of the Buddha's sayings, etc., he says, all that we are is a result of what we have thought. We are formed and molded by our thoughts. And this is what we mean. All we are a result of what we have thought and what we're capable of thinking and what we've been taught to think, if you will. And so we're said doggy, cat, tree, etc. So we've learned to partial up what is really seamless and what is really only one. Okay, and that is really important. So basically, what I've said, it may sound like nonsense, but there's been a remarkable convergence between Eastern thought, Buddhist thought, and modern physics in about the last 40 or 50 years. And let me, this is a little hard for me to read too, because it's Sunday morning, but here's something from the Tao of Physics, for example. The conception of physical things and phenomena as transient manifestations of an underlying fundamental entity is not only a basic element of quantum field theory, but also a basic element of the Eastern worldview. And what they're talking about is some kind of, we call it emptiness, and form rises from emptiness, okay? And physicists might call it something else. Buddhists express the same idea when they call the ultimate reality emptiness, or the void, and affirm that it is a living void which gives birth to all forms in the phenomenal world. Thus, the void of the Eastern mystics can easily be compared to the quantum field of some atomic physics. Like the quantum field, it gives birth to an infinite variety of forms, which it sustains and eventually reabsorbs. And so, just reflecting back, what's not self? What does it mean to be not self? And I think, I hope I've been clear enough to give you some idea about what non-self means. It doesn't mean that if I reach over and pinch somebody and they pinch me, we're not going to yelp. It doesn't mean that there's not a physical form or a body there. What it means is like a wave, we're a manifestation of emptiness, or whatever you want to call it, the Dharmakaya, Godhead, whatever you want to call it, etc. We can ask questions about the very nature of that reality, and that's metaphysics, and something the Buddha refused to do. The Buddha says, I only teach suffering, and I'm not going to get into metaphysical. That's all. That's enough to know about human beings is that we do suffer, and that we, I know basically the roots of suffering, and the roots of suffering lie solidly in the idea of a separate self. And so he didn't engage in those kinds of discussion, nor will I hear. How do we practice? How do we practice not self? And it's an interesting idea. And how do we go about practicing non-self? And it's an absolutely fundamental idea. And let me stress again that it seems the only way to stop suffering is to stop the idea of the self. And that's why it's so absolutely fundamentally important. It doesn't mean that you don't have a separate existence, but what it does mean is that you're part of this a greater whole. So three practices that we can try. And the first one is learning to see in a Buddhist way. And I say Buddhist, but it can be any way. Learning to see the way the world is. And we learn to see, and we probably haven't thought about it, when we see, we look through our face. Okay, we all look through our face. And we're a subject and you're an object. And we use all of those things that our language has labeled, dog and cat and tree and road, and things like this. And we say, they are objects out there, and I am in here. But if we're all one, if we're all part of a force field, and we're just manifestations, etc., then what's out there is in here. What's out there is in here. And if you haven't, if this is your first Buddha lecture at a Zen center, you may never come again. Because it sounds like nonsense, right? Nonsense. And we're talking about worldviews, and that's important. Now, so here's something to practice. When we sit in this room and we look around, rather than seeing people out there, see them in here. You're all one. There's no difference. There's just one, just you. Sit out in the backyard or on a bench and watch people go by and look at Lake Calhoun. That's all in you. There is no difference in you. And look at the stars at night and realize that they're no different. That you are all one. And this is why a Zen master says things like, I gulped the Pacific Ocean up in one gulp. How did he do that? With one breath, I took in the universe. I took the universe in. And this is exactly what they mean. And the book I have here, wherever it's not important, is a Dalai Lama book called The Universe in an Atom. The Universe in an Atom. There's no difference between an atom and a universe. And so do that practice. And when I think of that practice, a good way to put my mind on it, because it does sound strange, is to think of one of those optical illusions where you have a rabbit and a duck. Remember all those things? A rabbit and a duck, a beautiful woman and an old hag, an urn, or faces. I don't know if you remember those things. You look at the little drawing and all you see is a duck. And you look and you see the duck and that's all you can see. And then you learn and you look and there's a rabbit and then you can't see the duck. Okay? I don't know if you're familiar with those optical illusions or not. And that's exactly what we're dealing with here. That we've been taught throughout our lives to see the duck. We've been taught to see the duck. And that's it. And we've been taught to see the currents and waves and eddies of the ocean and not the ocean itself. Okay? So we have to learn. It's really hard because that's our upbringing. But we have to learn to see the rabbit and not the duck. Okay? If I've got them right, one way or the other. So that's basically, that's a basic exercise you can do anytime. When you drive your car as if you're in a movie. As if you're in a movie. And everything is you and there unfolding before you. Of course, there are real things, but they're all part of one. And so there's no better exercise in learning not self than driving a car and seeing yourself in a movie. Now, it takes some thought, it takes some practice, it takes some teaching to really understand this and to be able to see the rabbit rather than the duck. But I just mention it for something to think about. The second practice on not self is learn to say, who am I? Who am I? Who am I? And this is not a koan. We're familiar with koans. We'll say, what's the sound of one hand clapping? You should know by now, from what I've said, that we know what the sound of one hand clapping is. And it's the noise of emptiness rushing, cascading through eternity. Right? What else could it be? Okay? And why do we say, who's talking now? Who's riding the bicycle now? Who's whatever? And the reason is that we have to get rid of that final awareness. That final awareness, who's looking out and seeing things, and not part of the whole and not part of the one. Because in the first exercise, what we're trying to do is we're trying to see that we are one. And I am the woods, and the woods are me. Okay? I am the woods are me. And it's hard to see that. And so you work on who am I? Who am I? To get rid of that final bastion of ego. And that's the sense of personal awareness. Katagiri Roshi, who was the founding abbot here, said that the final barrier, the most difficult step in becoming awakened is to get rid of that final sense of I, that final awareness, the witness, if you want to call it, the observer. Who's looking at objects and seeing them separately, etc. So I don't know how that came across, but that practice of saying who am I again is one of the most fundamental, one of the very most basic practices you can do in Buddhism, etc. Because you're getting at that final awareness, and then finally the last practice is a loving kindness and and compassion practice, and that is once you realize that you are a part of emptiness and you're just a manifestation of it, you've gone from the many to one. You've gone from the many to one, and you've seen emptiness, etc. Now you come back from the one to the many. You come back from the one to the many, and fully aware that we're all one. And that all is emptiness. And so when you sit in that backyard or drive your car or walk around the lake, etc., everything you say, you see, is you. Everything you see is you. And so we can say, when somebody says, what was your face before your parents were born? You hold this up. There is no difference. There is no difference. What was your face? This is a typical Zen thing, etc. What was your face before the Big Bang? You hold this up. We are all one. We are all one. And in emptiness, there is no time. There is no space. There are no objects, etc. And so you come from the many back to the one. One practice you do is just everything you see, every blade of grass, every cat, every dog, every piece of earth, etc., you have loving kindness for it because you are one. There's no difference. I am you, and you are me. And so this is loving kindness. And loving kindness is just opening your heart, expecting no reward, just nothing. It's just this acknowledgement that we are one. We are one. And we have to help each other like brothers and sisters and mothers and children, etc. The second practice is a compassion practice. The difference between loving kindness and compassion is that in the compassion practice, you're dealing with people who are suffering, who are hurt. It could, again, be somebody died, they're ill, or just the general dis-ease. And in Buddhism, we use the word bodhisattva to mean a person who becomes enlightened in a sense and comes back basically and tries to help people around him. And therefore, to be a bodhisattva, you have to ascend into emptiness. You have to descend back into the world of form where you work with people who are suffering. And that's really an important difference. In the sutras, they talk about this metaphorically using the idea of mountains, that you ascend a mountain into the cave basically to see emptiness. And then you descend the mountain back into the towns and cities, etc., to live with people and be a bodhisattva. It's a basic idea of what we're what we're trying to do, being a bodhisattva, if you will. So let me end by giving a little quote from Wai Wu Wai. I don't know if you're familiar with Wai Wu Wai, but here's the quote. And he says, why are you unhappy? Because 99.9% of everything you think in everything you do is for yourself, and there isn't one. Let me say that one more time. Why are you unhappy? Because 99.9% of everything you think in everything you do is for yourself, and there isn't one. Why, it's pretty brief, but I hope I got the idea across that this idea of not-self, where it's initially it sounds difficult, I think, again, like suffering and like impermanence, ultimately it's not a difficult concept to understand. And I hope I got the idea across that it's absolutely a fundamental core concept of our practice to understand, because it underlies suffering, if you will. Okay, that's it. A few comments. I don't think I'm up to taking any questions. But any, yeah.
Guy, you have to completely counter culture.
What's that?
Non-self.
All right.
It's completely counter culture. So Asian cultures emphasize the we, it's more palatable. So how, then what are we left to do with our eye culture?
Well, I said I wasn't taking any questions. Well, I think a person who's, you know, if you're committed to this path, and if you're committed to awakening, etc., I think it's something, you know, basically that it's a worldview that basically you have to accept. Now, let me say that by saying that, it doesn't mean that you can't have money, that you can't have fame, that you can't have a good job or anything like that. It just means that you're recognizing the impermanence of those things, that you can be the wealthiest person in the world and you still have Emerson's underlying anxiety. You know what I mean? And so I think none of this says you cloister yourself, you stay up in a mountain. And in fact, there's something called the 10 Oxherder pictures. This is a roundabout way to avoid your question, but anyway, the 10 Oxherder pictures, etc. There used to be only 8. The 8th picture was a blank canvas, meaning that you had fully entered emptiness. There was nothing there. No time, no space, no objects, nothing, right? But that's not the Zen way. Okay, so the last 2 pictures, he's descending the mountain, and he enters the village, and he becomes a bodhisattva. Okay, and so I think there's a difference between isolating yourself in emptiness and fully entering the village again and living a full life just the way you are. Dogen said, who was the founding father of our lineage, Dogen said, before I started meditating, mountains were mountains. And as I studied emptiness, mountains were no longer mountains. And then when I awoke, mountains were mountains again. Okay, what did he mean by that? Etc. He knew when he was studying emptiness, of course mountains weren't mountains, because we realize that there's all one. There are no mountains, etc. There are no mountains. There are no trees, no cars, you know, nothing like that. But when we descend the mountain, we go back into the village, etc. When we live among people, mountains become mountains again. And so my answer is that it's probably no different between the way he lived before he went up the mountain and the way he's living when he came down. It's just a difference in perception. Now, I don't know if that's a satisfactory answer or not. But that's my answer, and I think that those are those ideas of fame in a grasping sense. There's nothing wrong with fame, but fame in a grasping, craving sense No, that's the disease. That's the suffering. Okay? And so there's a real difference between the... Any other comments? Okay, I realize that particularly for first comers, we do have cookies and things like that. Hopefully that's a reward. But at least you get a little idea, basically, of some of the things we think about, what some of our practices are. Thank you very much.